I'm Marty Moscow, and welcome to Radio Times. A recent report by the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists detailed how a Swiss division of the British bank HSBC helped wealthy customers hide billions of dollars from the tax man and handled secret accounts for drug dealers and arms dealers and blood diamond merchants. HSBC, one of the largest banks in the world, is under investigation in a number of countries after a former employee turned over documents to officials in France. We wanted to know more and asked Jared Ryle to be our guest. He's the director of the ICIJ, the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists. That's a nonprofit based at the Center for Public Integrity in Washington, D.C. In fact, he joins us from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C. And Jared Ryle, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Oh, thank you for having me, Marty.
You're very welcome. Help us understand, I guess, the scale of this leaked information. What is included or what was included in these documents?
What you're looking at is probably the biggest leak in history of Swiss banking secrets. You're talking about detailed notes on clients right around the world in about 200 different countries. And in their accounts was about $100
billion. $100 billion worth of their assets.
Worth of the client's assets, yeah, but it actually goes further than that. What we've got here is a snapshot of a whole year of those clients, the intimate secrets of those clients, because the bankers themselves kept extensive notes on the clients and were able to get a hold of those notes. And it really shows the, I guess, the intimate relationship that these people had with their bankers and how much knew the bankers actually knew about their lives, including the fact that a lot of these people hadn't declared their accounts.
Now, a man named Hervé Falciani got this information, took this information from the bank and initially handed over to French officials. How did the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, how did you get involved?
Well, this data set had been out there for many years, and in fact, many reporters around the world have been chasing it. We found out that two reporters at Le Monde newspaper in France got a hold of a subset of the data. What they got a hold of was the investigation that the French tax office did after the French tax office got a hold of the material.
And help us understand Hervé Falciani. You have written about him, and it's hard to. On the one hand, I guess he describes himself as a whistleblower, but he's a, shall we say, complicated whistleblower.
He's a very complex character. He was an IT expert who worked at the bank, and he set up systems inside the bank that allowed him to basically capture all of the, accounts and all of the details of the clients at the Swiss branch of the bank. At one point, he certainly tried to sell the material. He went to the Middle East and he tried to sell it to certain banks there. That alerted the bank. They asked for him to be arrested. At one point, he was in custody, but he asked for 24 hours. And at that point, he then got in a car and drove to his parents' house in France, where he was then subsequently arrested by French authorities.
And where is he today?
Well, he's actually turned state witness. The French, instead of turning him over to the Swiss authorities, he told them that what he had. And they then started opening up an investigation. And they initially looked at the French names, found that a lot of these people were avoiding tax. And then they found out that there were names from other countries. So in limited circumstances, they started handing the material over to other governments, including the IRS here in the US.
Indeed. Why did he leak this information?
Well, he says that what he found, his version is that he was a whistleblower, that he saw that this was something that shouldn't be happening. He claimed that when he was trying to sell the material, then he wasn't in fact trying to sell it. He was just trying to alert authorities and trigger alerts that would lead him to basically give this material away. He also says that he was in contact with authorities well before his arrest. The Swiss bank's version is that this guy stole the material, was trying to make money out of it. So it depends on who you listen to.
I mean, it has a kind of ring, Edward Snowden ring to it.
Oh, very much so. And it is a huge amount of material. I mean, this is something that has never been seen before in a Swiss bank. I mean, secrecy is what the offshore world sells. And HSBC was selling it to a lot of clients.
I mean, we think of Swiss Bank, and I think certain things come to mind. How should we understand what this branch of HSBC was doing in Switzerland?
Well, this was actually a bank that the HSBC had bought from a very famous banker called Safra. And what they were trying to do is it was a very lucrative part of their business. They've been on a buying spree for many years. The bank says that what happened in Switzerland is no longer happening. They're actually saying that because of Falciani, because of the stink over that, that they started cleaning up their act. And they now say that 70% of the clients they used to have at the Swiss branch are no longer clients.
Can you believe them, or should we believe them?
Well, it's very difficult. I mean, this comes up every couple of years. I mean, if you recall, this is the same bank that 2 years ago or 3 years ago now, 2012, there was a Senate investigation here in the US, and the bank was fined $1.9 billion at the time. And the allegation was that it was laundering money for Latin American drug cartels. They got a deferred prosecution agreement that is now continuing to last and will last for 5 years.
The idea of a fine instead of some kind of jail time?
Well, there was a famous, at the time, there was a famous editorial written by the New York Times that was headlined, "Too Big to Jail." And that seems to be the attitude that authorities have to these big financial institutions when they find wrongdoing.
Would it be fair to say, I mean, it looks like this information has made its way to authorities in other countries around the world, that at least this branch of HSBC is being looked at pretty carefully by authorities in other countries?
It was very historic when we wrote the stories now 3 weeks ago. The Swiss took it so seriously that they actually raided the bank. That's never happened before. Mm-hmm. But the history here is that ever since 2010, when the French authorities started handing the material over to other countries, there have been investigations. And we know that France is looking at potential criminal charges against the bank. So is Belgium. And there's also an investigation going on at the moment in Argentina. So before we published, we knew that all of these things were happening. So we knew this material was clearly indicative, at least, of wrongdoing by the bank.
Give us an example of one of this wrongdoing, and if we're talking about money laundering or even drug dealing or arms trafficking.
Well, we found many people who've been dealing with blood diamonds, and this is a source of conflict in Africa. And many of those people were clients of the bank. We looked at arms dealers, people that had been named in United Nations reports saying these are bad people, they've been doing bad things. We found many of them. We found some people who were on the sanctions list, the U.S. sanctions list. People who were bagmen for various dictators were clients at the bank at the time. You would have thought that the bank wouldn't want to do business with these kind of people.
Didn't they use pseudonyms or, you know, some kind of initials at least to hide their identity to some degree? Or is it more brazen than that?
Well, this is the kind of information that was never meant to come public. So they were being pretty open about who their clients were. In later stages, we found that some of these clients were hidden behind offshore companies. So what the bank was doing was setting up offshore companies for these clients and then putting the accounts behind those companies in, say, you know, the British Virgin Islands or Panama or other places like that.
But the idea is that the bank was complicit with these blood diamond dealers or arms dealers or drug traffickers.
Well, there was one blood diamond dealer in particular where the notes that were written by the bank staff said this person is now under investigation in Belgium for tax evasion. So, I mean, there were example after example of this happening where the clients were admitting to the through their account holders, that these accounts weren't declared in their home countries.
And how lucrative was this branch, branch of HSBC in Switzerland?
Well, they were creaming basically a percentage of all the money that was in there, because that's what happens with private banking. They take depending on the client and how big he or she is, they take a percentage of the money that's on deposit. So it was pretty lucrative.
We're talking about a crime here, are we not? Or levels of criminal activity on the part of the bank?
At least on face value, it does appear that way, yes. Obviously, the investigations have now got to go their full length and see what happens. But yes, that's what's being investigated in at least three countries now. And of course, since we published, a number of other countries have come forward saying that they're also going to now investigate.
And how long did the ICIJ, how long were you investigating or looking through these documents? Something, 2.5 million files? Did I read that correctly?
Yeah, there was about there were a lot of files. It wasn't quite 2.5 million, but we've been looking at this now for nearly 9 months. And so what we do is we gather material, you know, we gather the material themselves. We then share that material with media partners around the world, and then we get everyone together and we start digging.
So how long has this investigation been going on, and how many journalists involved?
Well, at the moment, there was about journalists from more than 50 organizations in 45 countries, with about 150 journalists in the end. And it's growing because we've now started adding more and more journalists as more and more journalists get interested in looking at the material.
And are you still looking, are you still discovering more material, or just going, you know, sort of digging deeper over the material that you have?
Almost every day now, there's another story being published in another country that's using this material and finding out things. We just had over the weekend in Brazil, the Senate there announced that we're now going to start investigating HSBC as a result of stories that we helped produce.
I noticed that the chief executive, a man named Stuart Gulliver, said recently, he said, "I'm responsible for clearing it up. I have made substantial changes." And of course, these were activities that go back almost 10 years. Is there evidence that things have been cleaned up at this branch of HSBC?
Well, the bank says that things have been cleaned up, but I guess history would say that this is something that just happens every couple of years, every time someone finds out about it. There's a lot of noise in the media. There's a lot of politicians who say they're going to change things, and yet the same patterns emerge again. Now, Gulliver himself had a secret account at his own bank. And in fact, this account was hidden behind a company, I think in Panama, from memory. And of course, he got in hot water for that because it became quite embarrassing. Now, he says that the only reason that he used a Panamanian company to hide his account was for privacy, because he didn't want his own staff to know how much he was earning every year.
Well, I should say it was $7.7 million, so a pretty good salary that he was earning as a chief executive at HSBC. We're almost up on a break here, but how many Americans involved in this particular branch of banking at HSBC?
From memory, I think we found about 5,000 clients that were linked back to the U.S., not all of them being U.S. citizens, because what you find is that America is a very important part of this whole world, because basically people want to have U.S. dollar accounts. So they had addresses in the U.S. that would indicate that they had at least homes here.
Well, let's take that short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Jarrett Ryle, and he's the director of the ICIJ. That's the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists. They have been looking into a Swiss division of the British bank HSBC and uncovering all sorts of nefarious-looking activities, including secret accounts for drug dealers and arms dealers and blood diamond merchants. We're going to take a very short break and get back to our conversation. You can join us at radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can certainly send us a tweet as well at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Jarrett Ryle, again, director of the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists. I should add that the ICIJ just received a Polk Award for its investigation into a series called Offshore Secrets, examining new ways that wealthy companies and individuals have avoided taxes. And we've been talking about the investigation at the Swiss division of the British Bank HSBC. And again, to join our conversation, send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Would it be fair, Jarrett, to say, or I do want to ask, whether everyone involved in this particular Swiss bank account, were they all trying to launder their money or evade taxes, or were there people there that were on the up and up?
No, there were a lot of people who were perfectly legitimate clients. And in fact, it's very important to make one point here, in that a lot of what happens in the offshore world is actually perfectly legal. And in fact, that actually makes it, for me, a much better story. It's okay to do this, but it's only rich people and people with very good advice who have the opportunity to avoid tax rather than actually evade tax. So it's very important to make that distinction.
Avoid meaning using the tax system to your advantage versus evading it, which would be, what, breaking the law?
Exactly. If you've got good enough advice, you can use these tricks to reduce your tax, the kind of tricks that the average person just doesn't even know about. And that's the kind of these are products that are sold by banks, such as HSBC.
Would it be also fair to say that there are probably some people that didn't even know that they had an account at this particular bank branch?
Yeah, there were some very famous people when we contacted them. They had no idea that their names were associated with HSBC. So what we found is that some people had made investments in technology funds or other kinds of funds. That technology fund was the one with the account, not the individual. So we had to make those distinctions. We took a lot of time contacting people before we published to see if we could put more context around why their names would appear.
And when we talk about offshore banking, I mean, Switzerland is not an island. How does offshore banking work?
Well, it's basically, again, it's all about secrecy. The kind of people who were clients at this bank were very, very wealthy individuals. At one point, you had to have $500,000 before you could open the account. Mm-hmm. I think today it's about $1 million, so, and it keeps going up. The reason why they've reduced their number of clients by 70% is because they've got tighter rules over who can afford to have these kind of accounts. This isn't an everyday account. This isn't like going around the corner to your local HSBC branch and opening a bank account. This is a high net worth individual kind of, you know, products that they sell. These are the kind of people they want to keep as clients.
And if we're talking about offshore banking and secrecy, is that legal?
It's all perfectly legal if you do it a certain way. The only thing that's illegal is that if you don't declare the account to your home authority. And in particular, here in the US, the rules around that are now very, very clear. And in fact, the bank, in a statement after we put certain questions to them, told us that in fact they're no longer looking for the US clients because it's just too much bother. Mm.
And how much stricter did it get in the United States, or has it gotten in the United States?
Well, I think the U.S. has been leading the push to end bank secrecy. But there is a real irony here because the U.S. actually benefits greatly from offshore banking secrecy because a lot of the money from Latin America and from other places all flows through Miami and New York. And in fact, a lot of it props up real estate prices over here. Everyone wants to have accounts in U.S. dollars, and the American system and the American people actually benefit greatly from this offshore secrecy.
Oh, that's interesting. I noticed in some of the reporting is that the bank's explanation was it was the individual's responsibility to pay their taxes or declare their taxes, not our responsibility. Is there some finger-pointing going on?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the clients in a lot of cases made it very clear when we read the notes. It made it very clear that they knew that these clients were not declaring their accounts in their home countries. But their attitude at the time was, well, it's not our business. It's up to them to voluntarily declare what they own. These days, the bank is saying that doesn't happen anymore, that the rules are very clear, or more clear now than they were then.
And if we think about offshore banking, and if we're talking about HSBC, which is a British bank, are we talking largely about British banks, or is it much more internationalized?
No, I think what you're seeing here is a systemic failure. This is not just about one bank. We just happen to have the details on this one bank. But there's been a pattern of misbehavior by big financial institutions over the last couple of years. HSBC is not the only bank to have been fined here in the US for wrongdoing. A number of other banks, including Swiss banks, have been fined.
Big fines? I mean, big fines in terms of bank assets?
Well, you're talking about billions of dollars in fines, but we did a calculation, and you could probably, for a bank, this is like about a month's profit. It's not very much money at all. It's only a slap across the wrist.
Meaning that there's the possibility they could continue to do what they do and just pay the fines and chalk it off to a month's worth of assets gone?
Well, there's an argument being made by anti, tax evasion campaigners saying that this will only stop when you start jailing people.
Yeah.
And that hasn't happened yet. And what's so significant about these stories that have come out in the last few weeks is that this is the first time that the Swiss authorities themselves are actually examining this bank for potential criminal behaviour. Until you have people going to jail, the argument is, anyway, that this will continue to happen.
Do you happen to agree with that argument? Or are you more agnostic on that argument?
Well, I guess I'm a bit more cynical than most people. I just think that they're going to find more and more sophisticated ways to do this. But it's our job as journalists to expose it. I don't think it's our job to comment or to get involved after you. Once we've published, we need to walk away and allow authorities and the public to decide what should happen next.
You've referenced several times the U.S. Senate did look into HSBC and, as you said, issued a fine, almost $2 billion fine. This was an investigation of a couple of years ago, also based on this same cache of data?
No, this was a completely separate set of data. It was the U.S. branch of the bank that was being investigated. What we're looking at is the Swiss branch of the bank. But the patterns were the same. And in fact, some of the customers were the same. So some of the people that were named in the Senate inquiry, we found also had accounts in Switzerland. And we're talking about, you know, allegations that were very, very strong that the bank at least helped or allowed terrorism funding to go on. And when we looked at the who the Swiss account holders were, we saw the same kind of people.
And what people are we talking about?
Well, in particular, there was a very famous list called the Golden Chain, which was the alleged 20 biggest funders of Al-Qaeda. We found four of them in the list that we looked at in Switzerland. The reason we didn't name them was because it's since kind of come out in court that a lot of these people probably weren't guilty of anything. But the fact remains that the bank should have known that they were named. And it was quite clear that they'd been publicly named and shamed when they still had accounts.
Would it be fair to say that this branch was seeking out these kinds of customers for themselves, or this was just sort of known within the world of offshore banking, is that you could go to this branch of HSBC and work in secrecy?
Well, it was all to do with money. These people were incredibly wealthy. Now, one example I'll use is Franz Merceron, who was the alleged bagman for Baby Doc Duvalier in Haiti. I mean, he had an account there. Now, the allegations, you know, was that Haiti had been, you know, robbed and basically looted by these kind of people. Who would want to have this person as an account holder? Mm. Well, HSBC were perfectly comfortable having him on.
Let me reintroduce you. That's Jarrett Ryle, and he's the director of the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists. And recently they did a joint investigation with 60 Minutes about money laundering and tax evasion at the Swiss branch of the British bank HSBC. And that's what we're talking about in this hour of Radio Times. Also talking about the fact that the ICIJ recently won a George Polk Award for business reporting and looking into, in fact, how companies, corporations have used Luxembourg as a place to stash some of their cash. We'll be talking about that as well. In the meantime, we have a tweet from Sarah. She says, "You keep calling HSBC a British bank. I thought it was a Chinese bank. Can you describe the organization chart of the bank?" And this maybe gets complicated. Jared, can you do that?
Well, it is actually a British bank. It's a Hong Kong Shanghai bank, but the origins may have started in Asia, but it is a British bank. It's listed on the British Stock Exchange, and it's actually the second largest commercial bank in the world.
Mm. But it also tells us, I mean, you can say something's a British bank, but with offices and branches around the world, sometimes hard to track down its origins.
Yes, it is. And what we're looking at here is the Swiss part of their operation. But of course, every part is linked to the other. And they had operations in Luxembourg as well and Britain. And of course, they have a big branch here in the U.S.
We have a Facebook comment from Esther. She says, "Bank secrecy has a long history in Switzerland. I'd like to know, in the opinion of Mr. Ryle, what the value of bank secrecy is these days and in what circumstances would it be important to maintain?" We touched on this earlier, but can you flesh that out for Esther?
Well, the argument for secrecy is that, you know, rich people, you know, for instance, if you were a rich person in a third world country and you faced getting abducted, or if your children faced getting abducted, then it's important to have secrecy around your wealth. That's the argument for. My argument is that as long as you have secrecy, you have the potential for wrongdoing. I think that every time we publish these kind of stories, we're actually hammering away at that secrecy. Mm. Because now if you have a Swiss bank account with another bank, who knows, maybe in another year's time, we will have those accounts and we will find a public interest argument to basically run stories about them.
But without this whistleblower, self-described whistleblower, Hervé Falciani, we wouldn't know this information, would we?
Well, in fact, if it wasn't for the two reporters at Le Monde who got a hold of the material from inside the French government, we wouldn't be even talking today. I mean, this material was handed over to the French government in 2008. Mm. It was then handed over to other governments in 2010. And yet here we are 5 years later before the public get to know.
We have an email from Carl. He says the U.S. government fined HSBC for laundering drug and terrorism funds. That was that fine of almost $2 billion. Why no criminal charges for bank personnel? Our jails are full of drug dealers.
Well, I think that's a very good point, and it's a point I was trying to make earlier. There is an argument here that as long as you keep fining financial institutions for wrongdoing, then nothing is really going to change because they'll just write it off as a business expense. And in fact, they'll probably claim it as a tax deduction as well.
But why the reluctance, do you think? I mean, you've looked at this, at how this money has been, in a sense, allowed to operate in secrecy. But why do you think the reluctance to throw anyone in prison?
Because of the kind of people we're talking about. And let me give you a good example of
sure.
that. So the head of this bank during this entire period was a guy called Lord Stephen Green from England. When this material was handed by the French, these documents were being handed by the French tax authority to the British tax authority, guess who was in power at that point? Hmm. Stephen Green had retired from HSBC and was a government minister in the current government. In England. He retired, I think, last year from the government. So you're looking at, you know, potential conflicts here. I mean, you know, why would the British government now go after a bank that was headed by one of its own ministers?
I mean, we have our own version of a revolving door in this country, but you're talking about a revolving door then in England.
Well, you're talking about very powerful and rich people, and you're also talking about very powerful political donors. I mean, we found quite a number of very big political U.S. donors who had accounts at HSBC. I'm not saying that they did anything wrong here.
Right.
But what I'm saying is that you're talking about the rich and the powerful.
Who are we talking about?
Well, we're talking about people who donated heavily to various campaigns. I don't want to name names because in some cases there's a lot of context around why they had accounts. And in some cases they're saying that they had accounts even though they didn't even know they had. They're kind of the examples of people who invested in various funds that ended up having accounts in the Swiss branch of HSBC.
So are we seeing a growth of what's been described as offshore banking?
Well, I think it's exploded, especially over the last couple of decades. But now I think there is the first cracks in this world because people are beginning to realize that along with the secrecy and the people with legitimate accounts, there's an awful lot of illegitimate accounts and illicit actions happening. We're talking, you know, particular terrorism, I think. After 9/11, it became clear that a lot of the funding for this kind of terrorism was going through the offshore world.
Are we talking trillions of dollars? Do you know?
Well, there's a couple of facts that I like to quote, and again, they're coming from people who, you know, lobby against this kind of world, but they're saying now that a third of all world wealth and half of all world trade goes through tax havens. So it's pretty amazing to think about that.
And we also know the sort of growing worldwide disparity between the rich and the very rich and everybody else. So this, you know, if there's that much money being held in secret bank accounts, that tells you just how rich people actually are.
Yeah, I think it's a very fundamental issue we're talking about here. Basically, if some people are not or allowed not to pay their taxes, then the rest of us, you and I, everyone here, is basically paying more as a result.
And would it be fair to say that the poor or developing countries are harder hit by these offshore banks than, let's say, more developed countries?
Absolutely. I think there's absolute clear evidence in the files that we're looking at that a lot of this money is coming from poorer countries. And it's the, you know, basically money that's being taken out of those countries and put into Western countries such as the US and Britain and Switzerland.
People that would be in power, perhaps even leaders of these countries that, I mean, we've known from past experiences that a number of these leaders will hide a lot of their money. I mean, desperately poor countries, very wealthy leaders that hide their money in Swiss bank accounts.
Well, we found, I mean, someone who was on the current sanctions list in the US, linked to the Assad regime in Syria, was in here. And that was just one of many, many examples that we found of very, very poor countries, politicians. We found, I think the number of politicians we found, the countries we found, went up to double digits. I mean, you're talking about everyone from people in Romania right through to Russia to other smaller countries.
Mm. Part of one of the reasons that your group won a Polk Award had to do with how members of the, and I'm re-quoting here from the Polk Award, members of China's wealthy elite hid their enormous fortunes, how criminal enterprises use New York real estate to launder money. Is there a short description of what that was about?
It was a series of stories that we've done. This is, you know, the latest version of what we've been looking at over the last couple of years. We've been looking at the whole, the various pillars of the offshore world. Those stories had to do with basically uncovering the secret offshore accounts that of the Chinese elite. And then we went on to do a series of stories that actually looked at how the people are using the offshore world to buy real estate in New York. And that was just one example. We also know that they're buying a lot of real estate in California and that it's driving up house prices in London and other major cities. It's basically the currency at the moment is real estate because it's safe.
Oh, because it's safe. And a lot of dot connecting, I guess, that you have to do as well. Let's take another short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. Talking with Jared Ryle, and he's the director of the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists. The Poynter Institute actually said the ICIJ is the biggest, toughest investigative unit you may never have heard of. And they did a joint investigation with 60 Minutes recently about money laundering, tax evasion at the Swiss branch of the HSBC Bank. That's a British bank. And we've been talking about some of the findings. And we're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. Any questions and comments, you can join us at Radio Times at WHYY.org. And you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Jared Ryle in Washington, D.C. from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C. He's the director of the ICIJ, the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists. That's a nonprofit based at the Center for Public Integrity in Washington, D.C. They recently detailed how a Swiss division of the British bank HSBC helped wealthy customers hide billions of dollars from taxes, also handled secret accounts for drug dealers and arms dealers and blood diamond merchants. And again, to join our conversation, send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. What you think about this investigation and how this kind of banking can be cleaned up. Jared, I'd like to talk to you about your investigation into Luxembourg and the numbers of probably well-known companies in this country have been using Luxembourg as a tax shelter. First of all, why Luxembourg?
Well, Luxembourg is a very interesting country in that you wouldn't think it was a tax haven. It's one of the founding members of the European Union. It's right there at the heart and the middle of Europe. But in fact, you know, when we think of tax havens, we often think of the Cayman Islands,
right,
or a place with the sun and some umbrella drinks. But that's what made Luxembourg so, I guess, so dangerous, because what was happening was that companies were basing themselves and are still basing themselves in Luxembourg. And you would not see that the only reason they're doing that is to actually avoid tax.
And is it just because they have sort of put out a welcome sign to some of these well-known companies, including Disney and Pepsi, FedEx, other companies as well?
Yeah, what happens is that what you try to do with a tax haven is that you try to make sure that your profits end up in that tax haven. And what Luxembourg were doing, and there's now a full European Commission inquiry into this as a result of the stories, is that basically these big multinational companies were making their profits out of selling goods here in the US, making sure that they also had a Luxembourg branch. And the Luxembourg branch basically was where all the money ended up, the actual profits. And then the Luxembourg government allowed these companies, or still allowing these companies, to be taxed at a fraction of what they'd be taxed at if they were here in the US.
Do you know what the rate was, that fraction of a tax rate, what it was or what it
well,
is?
The more money they put through Luxembourg, the smaller the amount was. In some cases, it was less than 1%.
Wow.
So if you're paying 25 or 30% here in the U.S., well, you can see the savings.
Your reporting also said that there's a loophole in the U.S. tax code, a check-the-box provision that, I guess, what, allows this to happen?
Yeah, I have to emphasize that everything we're talking about here is perfectly legal.
I know, I keep saying that to you. Right.
It's what made it a very important story, we thought. Yeah, and it's because basically the tax laws, if you've got good enough advice, and in this case it was PricewaterhouseCoopers, one of the biggest accountancy firms in the world that were giving this advice, all you had to do was, you know, basically make sure that your profits ended up in Luxembourg and your taxes went down by, you know, down from 25-30% to less than 1% in some cases.
I mean, the president and others have talked about doing away with these loopholes and bringing the money back to the United States. Based on the disparity in that tax rate, do you think that's even possible?
Well, what's happening here in the U.S. is that a lot of multinational firms have made huge profits, and all those profits are parked overseas in places like Luxembourg and Switzerland, and they can't bring the money back here to the US because if they bring the money back, they will get taxed on it.
Right.
So what's happening here is that there's a lot of lobbying going on to allow them to repatriate the money on a one-off deal, basically, where they get very, very little tax if they bring it back. In some cases, they're really in trouble because they've got billions of dollars parked overseas they can't bring back here to the US.
And what about states that act as tax havens? Certainly Delaware has a reputation for that.
Well, I would argue that the biggest tax haven in the world is here in the U.S. It's easier to open up an offshore account here and an offshore company here than in any other country. It's easier here than in the British Virgin Islands.
And when you say here, are we talking Delaware? Are we talking in other states? What else?
Well, Delaware is the best known, but in fact, what you find if you go through various scandals around the world, and we're talking about, I'll give an example, Daimler, which is one of the biggest manufacturers of motor vehicles. They were bribing officials in Eastern Europe for many years using companies that were set up, I think, in Nevada and other places here, and in Oregon.
So a lot of competition in this country to be a tax haven?
Well, again, you know, tax campaigners argue that it's been a race to the bottom here, where as soon as you have Delaware that's offering this kind of secrecy, then, of course, another state is competing with Delaware and they offer even more secrecy, and it goes on, and it's a race to the bottom.
So is this, I guess in certain ways there's domestic banking and then there's international banking. Who's the policeman here, if I can put it that way?
Well, the U.S. government would be the policeman here, but again, at the point I made earlier stands, there is no real incentive for the U.S. to end this because a lot of the money, the dirty money from overseas, is actually repatriated here and it's brought in here. And, you know, there is a huge financial incentive for the West to allow this to happen because the money is flowing from the third world into the richer nations and they're benefiting from this.
You also looked at the Clinton Foundation. Can you kind of spell that out, what your findings have been?
Well, it started with some, you know, I mentioned earlier that we got a lot of notes in these documents that were basically the notes written by the staff of the bank about their clients. And in one case, we noticed that there was $1 million transfer to the Clinton Foundation by one of the rich British clients. And that led us to have a little look at, well, who else is in there? Who else has donated to the Clinton Foundation? And we found quite a number of other donors that were in there, including Michael Schumacher, the famous Formula One driver.
Anyone else we should know about, though?
Well, there was a pretty famous Canadian and reasonably controversial guy called Frank Giustra, who was in there. And again, the person I mentioned earlier was Richard Caring, who is unknown in this country, but is a huge donor in Britain to the various political parties there.
But should question be questions be raised about the Clinton Foundation because of these secret bank accounts? Or is this just sort of the way the world of big money and wealthy donors exist or live?
Well, I would emphasize that there is nothing illegal with what's happening here. The $1 million, it turned out, was actually payment for Bill Clinton to turn up at a very lavish party that was thrown in St. Petersburg in Russia. It was a charity event. One of the other guests was Tina Turner, the singer. And Bill Clinton turned up dressed in a vintage Russian general's uniform. And that's what the $1 million was for. Now, the Clinton Foundation is obviously a non-profit, and this money goes to help people presumably in the third world. But what you're seeing here was essentially $1 million payment for turning up to an event.
And again, that's Jared Ryle, our guest in this hour of Radio Times, director of the Nonprofit International Consortium of Investigative Journalists. And we've been talking about a number of the investigations done by the ICIJ looking at banking, offshore banking and secret bank accounts and wealthy donors and corporations. And again, to join our conversation, send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. I do want to go back to this Hervé Falciani. So as you, he's a fugitive, and do you think there's more information coming from him, or his actions have opened a spigot somewhere else within this kind of high donor banking?
Well, I've been following Hervé over the last 2 weeks, and he's given a lot of interviews. Obviously, we didn't get any material from him, but he's now basically done a round of the media, and he keeps saying that, in fact, what we have is only a fraction of the original document set that he leaked, and that there is more there, that it shows wrongdoing and even more wrongdoing. And he promises that eventually it will come out. It'll be interesting to see if it does.
Indeed. And how much do you have to know about banking to be able to look through all these documents? I'm thinking about all the journalists that have been looking through these documents. How sophisticated do you have to be to understand what's going on?
Well, the hardest part was actually working out who were the clients and who weren't the clients. There were about 100,000 names that we managed to extract from the documents. And we found out from the bank later that only about 30,000 of these were actual clients at the bank. So there were a lot of people that had been listed as either former clients or were associated with accounts. Like, for instance, if there was a hedge fund that had an account at the branch, then all the owners of the hedge fund would be listed in the documents, even though those individuals wouldn't necessarily have been clients of the bank itself.
And has have you talked to others of the ICIJ? Have you talked with HSBC, been in conversation with them directly over some of this information?
Yeah, well, we put a lot of questions to HSBC just in the new year, about 4 weeks out from publication. And at that point, they reacted pretty strongly, and they demanded that we destroy the documentation.
Really?
We, of course, refused to do that, and we put very detailed questions to them. And at that point, their attitude changed, and they put out a 4-page statement that was much more conciliatory, where they basically admitted that a lot of bad things had happened. But they're saying that it was all in the past, that they weren't at fault, and that they cleaned up their act.
And what were some of those detailed questions that perhaps had them change their mind?
Well, it was listing the accounts of people who they should have perhaps known were dealers in arms or people who had dealt in blood diamonds. Really bad people. I mean, they were very, very precise questions. And we were able to link to, United Nations reports or public statements or even newspaper articles that had linked these people to kind of horrific things. I mean, like killing people and funding terrorism and funding civil wars in Africa.
It sounds like you were telling them we know more than you think we know, and that thereby forcing them to answer. I'm also curious about whether this is dangerous work. If you're talking about people laundering money and drug dealers and arms dealers and dangerous people.
Well, let me tell you a little bit more about the International Consortium, because what we do is we bring journalists from around the world together to work on projects. Now, after we'd been given these documents by the reporters at Le Monde, our task was to find out who we needed to invite on board the the collaboration. And so we started doing research work on the documents. We created tools that would allow journalists to look at the documents. And then one by one, we invited people from various countries to sample the documents to see whether or not there was a public interest in these documents. And at that point, once we realized there was, we invited everyone to a meeting in Paris at Le Monde's offices, hosted by Le Monde. And it was really that meeting in September that where we decided when to publish. The point I'm trying to make here is that you had a lot of reporters from various countries looking at these documents and helping each other understand them and go through them.
Does that make your organization unusual, do you think?
Well, I guess it provides a certain amount of safety. is this dangerous work? Yes, I think it would be very dangerous work if you were one person. I mean, Falciani, his story is almost, you know, like a, you know, tabloid, you know, newspaper story or something. It's his life is crazy. He claims to have been abducted by Mossad at one point. Wow. He claims to be, you know, living under armed guard now for the last 4 or 5 years. I do remember when I first talked to him, he was saying that, you know, if this ever came out, that his life was in danger and other things. You know, I think because of the way we tackle these stories involving so many journalists, it actually gives us a lot of protection.
Well, and also because it sounds like journalists from around the world, and perhaps more and more, we have to deal with global issues because of our interconnected world.
Well, also technology allows you to do this. And also look at the trends in journalism. The last couple of years, there is a trend towards huge data leaks. Right. You know, it began with WikiLeaks, it continued with Snowden. And over the last few years, we've been doing an awful lot of work in the offshore world that relies a lot on data leaks, huge data leaks, information that you could never possibly leak 10, 20 years ago before the rise of technology.
And also, just to sort of underscore what you're doing, this level of investigation requires time. I mean, oftentimes journalists don't feel like they have the time or even the sort of wherewithal to be able to deeply investigate issues.
Well, this is one of the strengths of the ICIJ. What we're doing is basically bringing reporters around the world together. And by sharing resources, we're able to do things that organizations probably would have been able to afford to do in the past, but no longer can afford to do because, of course, the whole basis of investigative reporting is that it's very expensive. And the financial, you know, basically the finances that allowed this to happen in the past are basically over because newspapers and the media are dying slowly.
And we're almost out of time here, but how did you get involved in journalism?
Oh, well, I went to journalism school in Ireland and I worked for some newspapers there before eventually migrating to Australia. And it was there that I managed to get into the whole area of investigative reporting, which is taken over my life since.
Oh, really? I mean, it has a way of doing that, doesn't it?
Well, it's all highs and lows. And in fact, if you do this kind of work, you realize that if you get onto a good story, there is nothing better. But then there's this huge trough in between where you've got to try and find the next story. And you only enjoy a story if it's better than the last one. So it's a continual, I guess, striving towards perfection that you'll never reach.
And can we assume you're continuing, your organization continuing looking at this banking system? Is that ongoing for you?
It is ongoing, although we are doing other kinds of stories. We're in the next, hopefully the next 6 weeks, we're going to publish something that will be something that's completely different to the offshore banking world. But of course, when you start investigating a certain area, you become a magnet for more leaks and more stories in that area.
Well, Gerard Ryle, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times, and thank you for your investigative work on this very important issue.
Thank you very much for having me.
You're very welcome. And he's the director of the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, and you can check out their website and get more information on the investigations that they have been doing into offshore banking. You can also go to whyy.org/radiotimes and find out much more about this program. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thanks for joining us in this first hour of the show. Do stay with us for hour two. We'll be right back.